Sometimes, you know, I'm very excited to preach a sermon. Other times, not as much. I'm preaching a sermon this morning on a subject I feel grossly inadequate to teach on. Fortunately, or unfortunately, the Bible doesn't give me the freedom not to preach on this because it's there. So I'm going to be addressing a subject that Facebook has forever changed the understanding of this subject. Facebook has forever changed the definition of one important word in this life, and that word is friend. Now, I don't care what my Facebook page tells you. I do not have 463 friends. The number is much lower than that, in fact. Not how the word has traditionally been defined anyway, which is one attached to another by affection or esteem. One attached to another by affection or esteem. Now, I have 463 people who have either sent me a friend request or who have clicked accept to my friend request, which is very rare. If you've received a friend request from me, consider yourself one of the very lucky few. Now, I'm not here to dunk on Facebook. You know, I mean, Facebook is fine. I use Facebook. I'm not even saying there's anything wrong with having the kind of relationship that Facebook affords you to have. I'm not even adverse to saying that that is some kind of friendship. But it's just not what friendship has been understood to be for the thousands of years before Mark Zuckerberg came along. Friendship is much more than clicking accept request and then liking the occasional photo that person has posted. That is not what we would define as a good friend. Good friends are hard to come by, aren't they? Some people have a lot of friends. Some people have a few friends. Some people don't have many friends at all. I confess, that was me growing up. Some people have lots of friends, and you know, you can have lots of friends, that's fine, but I would submit to you that, how many of them would you call good friends? You know, you can have lots of friends, but they can't all be good friends, they can't all be close friends, they can't all be friends that are there for you through thick and thin, friends that are there with you in the battle that we call life. Most of us are lucky if, in fact, we have one or two friends like that in our entire life, I think. The reality is that good friends are vastly important in life, and I would suggest to you more important even in the Christian life. You see, Jesus describes the Christian life as the way that is hard. Not the way that is easy, the way that is hard. And then he goes on to say there are few who find it. So with that in mind, I think we can all agree that it can surely be made easier or at the least better on that road with a good friend, a close friend, a friend which the Bible describes as a friend which sticks closer than a brother. Now, if you have been blessed to have that kind of friend, a friend who sticks closer than the brother, then I would suggest to you that you thank God for that, because a friend like that is rare. In fact, the Bible tells us a friend like that is rare. And that is why, and not only should we thank God if we have a friend like that, we should seek to be a friend like that, the kind of friend who David meets in our text, a loving, faithful, humble friend. This is our text for this morning, 1 Samuel 18. We get a short one. A reprieve from all the long texts. I'm just going to preach today from verse 55 of chapter 17 through to verse 5 of chapter 18. So I hope you have your Bibles and you're following along. 1 Samuel 17, starting at verse 55. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So, last week we picked up the story in the middle. Today we pick up the story at the end. David, the young shepherd who had taken down bears and lions, now takes down God's people's most formidable enemy, a well-armored 9.5-foot Philistine warrior named Goliath. But to be sure, you hopefully remember, David had made clear that the victory did not belong to him. He made clear that Goliath had defied God in defying God's army, and God was thus the one who fights for and saves his people. So David wants everybody to know, not just everybody at the battlefield, but everybody everywhere for all time to know that the battle belongs to God. But in light of David's impressive fight, while the battle belonged to God, there were some other things that belonged to David. You see, Saul had offered a reward for slaying Goliath. And that's what David did. And so, rightly, David had some things coming to him. He had riches coming to him. He had Saul's daughter coming to him. And he had freedom for his family coming to him. This was what he was owed. So with that in mind, the narrator tells us about something that happened before the battle and then afterward. So when David told Saul that he wanted to go fight Goliath, Saul wanted to know something about David. And he wanted to know primarily who David's family was. And he wanted to know this for two reasons. First of all, he was going to give his daughter to whoever defeated Goliath, which meant that whoever defeated Goliath was going to become his son-in-law. And if you're going to have a son-in-law, not looking at anybody in particular, you want to know where your son-in-law comes from. You know, you want to know some things about your son-in-law. You want to know if your son-in-law is worthy for your daughter. But more importantly, I think, for Saul, not rightly, but more importantly for Saul, I think, was more concerned about how this was going to reflect on him, what this was going to mean for him, if he was going to have David in his kingdom as part of his family. But second, he would also need to know who David's family is, because if he was to honor his commitment to set them free, which was to exempt them from taxes and other obligations to the palace, he needed to know who they were. So as David goes to the battlefield, Saul asks Abner about who David's family is, who is his father. But Abner doesn't know, so Saul sends Abner to get an answer from David, which of course he can't do because he's on his way out to battle. So we then read that after David took Goliath down with his sling and stone, chopped off his head with his own sword, it says, as soon as David returned from striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." There's a few things I want to say about this. The first is that this is a baller move, if you ask me. Because David comes in to see the king, and he has Goliath's head in his hand. Now, come on now. He is not messing around. Like, I don't know what says who's the champion now. Like, walking in to see the king with Goliath's head. I mean, the guy was 9.5 feet tall, and David's holding his head. I mean, just get a visual picture of that in your mind. I mean, that's what people say when they read the Bible. They can picture what's happening. I have a hard time with that. You know that. I don't make pictures in my head. I just kind of read words and understand what the words say. But man, I can see that. Drip. Drip. Come on. The Bible is the best, right? Anyway, I just want to say, I mean, right out of the gate, David is too cool for school. That's all there is to say. Now, there's something else here to say that some of you might have been wondering last week when you left. You know, maybe you thought, oh, he's not going to address this because this is one of those things in the Bible where it's like, come on, what's going on? Some people read what's going on here and they seem to think that Saul is saying, who is this guy? Like, who is this guy? Like, as though Saul doesn't know who David is. But I don't think that's what's going on here at all. I do not think that Saul is saying, who is David? I think Saul is saying, who is David's father? I mean, that's what it says. He says, he wants to know, whose son are you, young man? Who is your father? That's what he's asking him. Now, you might think that there's still a problem here because you think, now hold on a minute here. Remember way back when Saul hired David to work in his kingdom, didn't the servant tell Saul who was David's father? And my answer is yes, he did, but I still don't think there's a problem here. Because first of all, I don't think that the king of Israel is expected to remember the family members of every employee in his kingdom. I think that would be very rare if he in fact remembered that. But second of all, consider the context in which that information was spoken in Saul's presence. The context was God had sent a harmful spirit. A spirit that was intended to torment Saul. God had sent this spirit to torment Saul, and Saul was visibly tormented. And somebody says, hey, you know what? I know this guy. And and Jesse's his father, and he can help you. What do you think Saul just heard? Saul just heard, I know a guy that can help you. And I don't want to say that men are better at this than women. I think we all do this from time to time. But I think that Saul kind of heard that Jesse was David's father. I don't think he really listened. I don't think he really took that in. I don't think that was important information to him at the time. So, yes, Saul was told that David is the son of Jesse. But I think it's entirely conceivable and even likely that Saul never really took in that information. And so now that David has defeated Goliath, now that Saul has obligations to fulfill to David and his family, now I think he's like, now tell me again, who is this guy's father? This guy who was a shepherd now is a soldier. This guy who used to just play the lyre and now plays the warrior. This virtually unknown man in Israel who is now the most famous man in Israel. And we'll get to that in next week's text. So this really now just sets up things for the text this week. This just brings us to our text for today. David has come before Saul to identify his father. And guess who's there when David comes to see Saul? His son is there. Jonathan is there. Now, we've met Jonathan before in 1 Samuel, a couple times, in fact. And we'll get to some of what we've learned about Jonathan as we move on here. But as we go through these verses, chapter 18, 1 through 5, I want to submit to you that we will learn three things about Jonathan. And in so doing, we will learn three things concerning what makes a good friend. So while I might not be that qualified to tell you this, the Bible most definitely does. And they are these three things. A good friend loves you. Surprise, surprise, right? A good friend is faithful, and a good friend is humble. So I know no big surprises here. A good friend loves you, a good friend is faithful, and a good friend is humble. So let's see how we see this from the friendship between Jonathan and David. So our text begins with the narrator making a statement about the friendship between David and Jonathan. And I think based on this statement, it would be an understatement to not say that Jonathan and David became fast friends. They became fast friends. Now, I think Jonathan had probably taken an interest in David before this, maybe when he came around as the lyre player, but most definitely when he came along and defeated Goliath. That said, from the way the narrator words this, and of course, we need to recognize that this is a summary of what has happened. We don't know everything about what happened here. But the way the narrator writes this, it seems like David just shows up on the scene And immediately him and Jonathan are friends. Immediately Jonathan takes to him. It says, as soon, and again, like, you know, don't minimize the way things are written here. They're written intentionally. It says, as soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. Another way of saying this would be to say that Jonathan was bound to David in a close friendship. That's how the Christian Standard Bible puts it. Or the New Living Translation says there was an immediate bond between them, an immediate bond. So, I mean, I think we all know, like, some friendships take a lifetime to grow, right, and blossom. And other friendships just pop out of the ground like a weed. Right, you know what the analogy is here, right? I'm not saying good immediate friendships are like weeds. I'm just saying, you know, they pop up real fast. So this friendship was clearly one of the latter kinds of friendships. It just blossomed from the moment they met. Jonathan immediately esteemed David and was immediately drawn to him. And the question we should ask is why? Why? I mean, we would like to have these kinds of friendships, wouldn't we? I mean, some of us are kind of hermits and introverts and all that sort of thing, but I think deep down, we would all like to have a good kind of friendship like this. So the question is why did they have this kind of friendship immediately? And I think it was because they both shared the same worldview. I think they both shared the same worldview. So do you remember one of the first things that we learned about Jonathan? The first thing we learned about Jonathan is that when he comes on the scene, there's skirmishes between the Israelites and the Philistines, which is kind of all throughout. But the first thing we learn about Jonathan is that he rushes in and takes over a Philistine garrison. He was successful in this. And if you recall, Saul came along then and claimed that victory for himself, which as king, you know, was appropriate. But nevertheless, right away, the narrative sets up this contrast between Saul and Jonathan. Saul's holding back, and Jonathan, these are enemies of God, and he's going in to take them. And that's exactly like David, isn't it? So David and Jonathan shared this desire to see God's righteousness dispensed upon enemies of God's people. They both shared this desire, but it was not just the desire they shared, but both of them were willing to demonstrate that desire through courage and the willingness to fight against God's enemies and thus protect God's people. They both showed themselves to be protectors of God's people. But it was more than a desire and more than a demonstration of a desire that Jonathan and David shared. It was, in fact, a trust in God that they shared and a desire for him to be glorified. This is what they shared. Let me remind you of a second thing that we learned about Jonathan. This is probably the thing that you remember more so than the first thing, and that's that he came upon a Philistine garrison a second time. But this time, there was just him and his armor-bearer and one sword between the two of them. So clearly, the odds were heavily against them, and this is what Jonathan says. Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Do you remember what David called Goliath? That uncircumcised Philistine. And then Jonathan goes on to say, it may be that Yahweh will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. Now, you remember that David went in and he said, winning is happening here, right? But that's because he was anointed as king, and there was other things going on with Goliath, whereas Jonathan, he comes along and he doesn't know, but he knows that it may be that the Lord will work for us, and if we're going to win, it's going to have to be the Lord that works for us. Now, I think that's very similar what Jonathan says here to what David says when he comes upon Goliath. I think that both Jonathan and David know that it's not a good idea to be an enemy of God's people. I think both Jonathan and David know that salvation comes from God. And I think that both Jonathan and David know that it doesn't matter what the odds are. Right? Very similar situations, but for different reasons, right? Jonathan comes along this garrison, and there's presumably hundreds of men and just two of them. And he says, I don't care. God can win if he wants to. And David comes up to Goliath, who, of course, outweighs him and outheights him and out-armors him. And he says, hey, don't worry about it. Like, they both know that it doesn't matter what the odds are. God has all the power he needs to save his people. And God acts for the good of his people. That is why I think Jonathan and David became fast friends, because they both trusted the Lord and they both had a desire for the Lord to receive glory. They did not share a similar upbringing. One of them was brought up as a shepherd, and one of them was brought up as a prince. They did not share the same age. Jonathan had to have been at least 10 years and probably more older than David. But what they did share was a trust in the Lord and a desire for his glory through the salvation of his people. And I ask you, can there be any bond stronger than that? I don't think there can. I think that this is the only friendship, now hear me now, the only friendship that will last forever. Because thanks to Michael W. Smith, me and every Christian kid who grew up in the 80s knows that friends are friends forever if the Lord's the Lord of them, right? Now, if you didn't grow up in the 80s, you don't know what I'm talking about, but a very, very famous song. But there's truth. That is true. Your friend will only remain your friend forever if you share the same Lord. If the Lord is your Lord and the Lord is their Lord. This is the case here with Jonathan and David. Now, we can have friends with unbelievers and argue even that we should have friends with unbelievers, but they cannot be as strong as the friendship that you have with someone else who you are united to Christ by faith with, because that's a friendship with a bond unlike any other bond. It's the only friendship which will have no end. That is why Jonathan loved David, because they had a shared faith in Yahweh, and more particularly, why it says he loved him as his own soul. Now, I know, men don't often say that they love each other. Yeah, I think that's okay. it's okay if you say you love me, you text, you love me. It's okay. I mean, men are changing these days. It's okay. So it's okay to say it. It's also okay not to say it. I mean, you need to know, I was brought up in a home. It was not said. It was never said. I say it every now and then now to my folks, and it still feels weird because that's just something we didn't say. No, I knew I was loved, but we just didn't say it, and that's okay. As long as the love is there, you don't have to say it. Now, as an aside, I'm going to say something controversial here. I don't usually say things that controversial, I don't think. But I'm going to share with you an opinion that I have. And my opinion, I've shared this in private a number of times. I'm going to say it from the pulpit here, and I'll deal with the blowout afterwards if need be. Hopefully there won't be any. My opinion is that women were not intended to be close friends with men. And that men were not intended to be close friends with women, of course, other than their wife, or in the first case, their husband. I believe that men should be close friends with men, and women should be close friends with women. So if a man wants to be a close friend with a woman, he should either be courting her or married to her. And while this sermon does not afford me the time to provide a lengthy explanation of why I hold this opinion, and I will gladly admit that I cannot point you to chapter and verse, but I can point you to a lot of chapters and a lot of verses and an overall idea that leads me to this conclusion. But what I will say here this morning is that I think our text provides what might be one of the best examples of friendship in Scripture. I don't think anybody would, can you think of another one that's more clear than this one? I mean, I don't expect to be preaching on friendship anytime soon again until maybe we get to the Proverbs. There's a lot in there. But this, I think, is, if not one of the best example of a friendship. And we have to assume that that friendship had more significance or was stronger or was the way it was because they shared the same gender. I think that contributes to the strength of their friendship. Now, there's a lot more that we've said about that, especially as it has to do with you know, relationships and marriage. I think it mostly comes down to the issue of marriage when it comes to men being good friends with women and vice versa. But nevertheless, there you go. Take it as you wish. I'm not going to check my email today, so if you want to send me angry emails, I'm not going to get it till tomorrow. Okay. As for the love that Jonathan has for David, nothing more controversial here, I don't think. You're going to notice that it says he loves him as his own soul. That's just a fancy way of saying he loves him as himself, right? He loves him as he loves his own soul. And surely many of you recall that this is, in fact, the second greatest commandment according to Jesus, to love your neighbor as yourself. So, I mean, this is the kind of love that we should have for all people, but, well, for the most part, for most people. So this is, of course, the kind of love that you should have for a friend. But what does that mean, to love somebody as you love yourself? You know, I highly doubt that many of you look in the mirror and go, man, I love you. Now, I bet you some of you do. Some of you got pride issues, I know. But, you know, I mean, what does that mean, to love yourself, right? To love yourself is just simply to want the best for yourself, to be concerned about your own well-being. And I think this is simply that, to want what is best for others, just like you want what is best for yourself. I'm sure many of you have had friends in your life, or people that identified as friends, that weren't really friends, were they? And the reason that you knew they weren't friends is because it was only a one-way relationship, right? You gave and you gave and you gave and you gave and you gave, and then when you needed something, crickets. Nothing, right? Nowhere to be found. Now, sure, some friends are more needy than other friends. That's okay. But a true friend loves you like he or she loves him or herself, which is to say, a true friend loves at all times, not just when it's good for them. And the closest of friendships, as I said, is the friendship which is founded on a mutual trust in the Lord and desire for him to receive glory in all things. That's the kind of friendship that Jonathan and David had. Jonathan loved David as he loved himself. Now, Jonathan, it says here, he showed his love for his friend in a particular way. It says, verse 3, then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Now, if you know, I love talking about covenants. I'll talk about covenants all the live long day. We talk about covenants around here all the time. But usually we're talking about covenants between God and man. But here we find a covenant between two men. And a covenant is basically a formal agreement between two parties in which both parties agree to the parameters of the relationship set out in the covenant, right? So marriage is a covenant. You covenant together, you know, with your wife or your husband to be faithful to one another, you know, to have and to hold in sickness and in health, blah, 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 right? So that's a covenant. When you become a member of a church, that's a kind of covenant. Because you're agreeing to be bound by the parameters of the relationship of being a member to the other members of this congregation. There are things that are required of you. That's a kind of covenant as well. Now, technically, what the narrator tells us is that Jonathan cut a covenant with David. Only one translation will tell you that, and that's the it's a new translation. It's kind of a new translation of an old translation. It's called the Legacy Standard Bible. It's basically a redo of the New American Standard Bible with some important changes, I would say. If they had taken the ESV or the CSB and made these changes, I'd be all over it. But you know me, I'm not a big fan of the NASB. Great translation, but just not a big fan. But the LSB tells us that Jonathan cut a covenant with him. And that's important to know because the reason that they would say they cut a covenant, and some of you know this already, I know, but I'll just remind you anyway, is that what they would do is they would cut up animals. Yeah, cut up animals. And then they would walk through the animals as the blood is dripping. Drip, drip. It's a bloody text today, isn't it? But that's what they did. They cut up animals, and then they walked in. The two of them walked between the animals. And what they were saying, essentially, as they walked between the animals, is that if I break the terms of this covenant, let me be like these animals. Now, I'll tell you, I don't know if they actually did that in this case or not. But what I do know is that by cutting a covenant, they were saying that they were committing to be true to the terms of the covenant. to the parameters of the relationship. Now, surely you must notice, hopefully you read the text before today, you'll see there's nothing said about this covenant. We don't know anything about this covenant, right? I don't know if any of you have made covenants with your friends. I've never made that kind of covenant with a friend, but I would just call this simply a covenant of friendship, which is to say, I think they were covenanting to be friends with one another through thick and through thin. Maybe it's kind of like... what did they do? You used to use make a blood oath or something, you know, or you'd cut your hand and then the other guy would cut your hand, then you'd shake hands, and maybe I don't think that's what's happening here, but that's essentially what they were saying. They were committing to be friends forever and ever, amen. That's what the covenant was all about. They didn't need to enter a covenant, I don't think. I don't see any other covenants of friendship. There was a covenant similar to this between family members, But the point is they didn't need to do this. It appears that Jonathan wanted to make formal his friendship with David. He wanted to make it official. He wanted to make it clear that they were going to be friends forever because the Lord's... No, I'm not going to go there. Never mind. But that's what's going on here. They're going to remain friends. Now, I don't know about you. I've had a number, not a big number, but a number of friendships over the years that came to an end. Not because I wanted them to, but because they had to for one reason or another. But with Jonathan and David, their friendship was not going to come to an end. This is what this covenant was all about. Their friendship was one for the record books. Jonathan made a covenant of friendship with David. This was surely a declaration of his intent to be faithful to David as a friend. And David reciprocated. They both made a covenant to remain faithful as friends. Jonathan was a faithful friend. He was not a fair-weather friend. He was not a friend for a time. He was a friend for all time. Now, the last thing we learn about Jonathan is that on top of being a loving friend and on top of being a faithful friend, he is a humble friend. But before we get to that, let's look at verse 2. You'll notice I skipped verse 2. We learn something about Saul, and Saul is going to become the emphasis of the text next week. But in verse 2, it says, Saul took David that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, not at all, because you remember when Samuel told Israel that they could have a king, so long as they knew what a king would do? And do you remember one of the first things he said that a king would do? A king will take your sons. So here he is taking Jesse's son. But there's a second reason this doesn't surprise us, because we know about Saul's strategy for building a strong army, because back in 1 Samuel 14:52, it tells us that when he saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to him. So surely David was a strong and valiant man, demonstrated by the fact that he was currently holding the head of Israel's most fierce enemy in his hand. Right when it was out of your brain, it's back in, right? You're welcome. So Saul took him, and it says at verse 5, David went out, was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war, and this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So Saul takes and uses David for his own good. But that is not the way of Jonathan. No. While Saul takes, Jonathan gives. And what he gives is no small gift. Rather, Jonathan strips himself of the robe that was on him, gives it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. Now remember who Jonathan is, everybody. Jonathan is the son of the king. He is from a worldly perspective. He is the one who is to inherit the throne. He is the crown prince, as you would have it. Now, we know that he's not going to take the throne, right? We know that that God had rejected Saul as king and had anointed David to serve as the next king. But we might fairly ask if Jonathan knew. What did Jonathan know, in fact? Some think that he must have known, while others, like myself, question whether he really would have known. I'm not sure he would have. It's hard to know what Jonathan would know, but what we do know is that this is of extreme significance, or what we should know is that this is of extreme significance, that the reigning crown prince takes the garments that he has on, the things that identify him as the one to take the throne next, he takes them off and he gives them to David to wear. This is a most generous and most significant gift from Jonathan, and it was something that all of Israel would see. All of Israel was going to see that Jonathan had taken what identifies him as the crown prince and given them to David. I mean, that's not something that we should expect to see. No, we should expect to see from the prince of Israel a quest to take power. That's what we normally see in a crown prince, a desire to ascend to the throne. I mean, couldn't you see Charles' lips just dripping? Like, he had waited for that for years. That's another story. But nevertheless, I mean, when you see someone that is next in line for leadership, what we often see in people like that is pride and arrogance and a desire to climb the ladder and seize power in any way whatsoever. But that's not what we see in Jonathan. In Jonathan, we see a humility which is happy to step aside and see another succeed. Happy to see another rise to power. Now, I don't think that Jonathan's gift is a public acknowledgement of David's right to the throne. I don't think that is necessarily what is happening, as though Jonathan is saying David is the one to take the throne next, because I don't know if Jonathan even knows that. But what I do believe, as one commentator said, I forgot to write his name down, I think that this ironically foreshadows David's future royal status. I think that what Jonathan does is saying something that he might not even know that he's saying, but he is saying it, that David is in fact the crown prince, the one to take the throne next. Whatever it does or does not communicate about Jonathan's understanding of who is next to the throne, clearly Jonathan is not threatened by David's success. He humbles himself before his friend. He puts the interests of David above his own interests. And isn't that what marks the best kind of friend? Jonathan was a good friend, a close friend. And I think that we are surely to learn from this kind of friend that he was to David. First, I think we should learn that if we have a friend like that, we should be grateful to God for that friend. But I think we also learn that we should ask God to grant us the desire and the character necessary to be that kind of friend to others. A loving friend, a faithful friend, and a humble friend. But there is just one last thing. And it's that Jonathan, yes, he is surely a friend who sticks closer than a brother. But Jonathan points to an even better friend. And let's consider this better friend in comparison to Jonathan. So when Jonathan loved David as himself, David loved Jonathan back. It was a mutual friendship. Jonathan loved David, David loved Jonathan. But there is a friend who loves his enemies and shows his love for them when they hate him and are in opposition to him. Now, Jonathan, he covenanted together with David. And we have to assume, I think, we have to assume that they both had parts in this friendship. They both were covenanting together. It does say that Jonathan made the covenant with David, but I think we have to assume that they both had parts in that covenant. Now, there is a better friend who covenanted with those whom he showed his love to, but the covenant was all of grace, which is to say this friend did everything that was necessary for you to be in covenant with him and to have him as your faithful friend forever and ever. And the way this friend showed his love, get this, and the way he entered into covenant with those he came to save was like Jonathan. He gave up his royal garb. But unlike Jonathan, he only did this for a time, as he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name above every name. Surely, there is no friend like Jesus, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And can there be any greater privilege than having him call you a friend? But he does. In Jonathan 15 and 16. But if that is what you want, if you want to stand before Jesus one day as your friend and not as your judge, you must turn from your sins and trust in him. That means you must trust that he died for your sins and rose to give you life. You must humble yourself before him as you confess him as Savior and Lord. And then You live as a member of his covenant people. That is the first step to becoming a good friend. A friend which Jonathan was to David, which is to say a loving, faithful, and humble friend.